I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest is Mark Jacobs, a Republican candidate for Iowa's U.S. Senate seat. The GOP primary is June 3rd, and this interview is being recorded on Friday, May 23rd, 2014. Welcome, Mark Jacobs.
Ben, thank you. Great to be with you today.
Let me start by having you give us an example of an experience you had as an energy company executive, the CEO of Reliant Energy, that you believe prepared you to be a U.S. senator.
Well, Ben, thank you for asking. I might back up a little bit before I became CEO of Reliant Energy and just talk about Reliant Energy when I joined the company as chief financial officer back in 2002. And when I joined the company, it was on the verge of bankruptcy. It was a company that had $9 billion in debt. It was under federal investigation. And in short, it was one of those situations where anything that could have gone wrong had gone wrong. And the day I walked in the company, I was sitting across the table from 23 of the world's largest banks that had lost confidence in the leadership of the company, and they were ready to step in and take over control. And they thought they were going to dictate to me what was going to happen next. And I had a couple principles that I was not going to negotiate upon. I wasn't going to settle for a short-term solution, and I wasn't going to hand over control of the company to the banks. But I listened to them. I worked with them, did a lot of pushing and cajoling, and ultimately we got this group of banks to agree to a long-term extension that gave the company some breathing room. And to make a long story short, during my 8 years at Reliant as chief financial officer and chief executive officer, we were able to take that $9 billion plus in debt and turn that into less than $2 billion of debt by repaying $7 billion, and we protected thousands of jobs. So I know what it's like to inherit a fiscal mess, but more importantly, I've learned how to work with people to get things done, and I think that's what's missing in Washington today.
Mark Jacobs, what is the one thing you can do in the Senate to help create jobs in Iowa?
Well, my view is that the government doesn't create jobs. That's the role of our businesses here in the state of Iowa, our farms, our manufacturers. But the government does create an environment that makes growth in the private sector either easier or more difficult. And I'm the only candidate in this race that has a job creation plan that's oriented around how we create that environment. And just to touch very briefly on the five key elements of that plan, number one, closing the skills gap by focusing on community colleges and vocational schools. Number two is to increase energy production in America, including renewables here in Iowa. Number three, we have to deal with that costly regulatory regime that we have. Number four, we need a tax policy that encourages growth right here in America and brings jobs back to our shores. And number five is Obamacare, which we need to repeal, and we need a fundamentally different approach with health care.
A business-related question. In March, an Iowa poll showed 65% of those polled in Iowa support an increase in the minimum wage. Would you support a minimum wage increase?
Well, I agree with Senator Grassley on this one. That's something we could look at. But as I think about it, it's another example of our career politicians in Washington that attack the symptom of the problem rather than the root cause. In my view, the root cause of the problem we have in America today is a lack of good jobs. And that's why I'm very focused on creating an environment where we can see better growth opportunities in the private sector.
Let's turn to energy, and specifically energy that has a lot to do with the Midwest. The proposed changes to the renewable fuel standard seem to signal that the administration may move away from grain-based alternatives to conventional fuels. What would you do in Washington to work in a bipartisan manner on energy policy that would benefit Iowans and still have national appeal?
Well, I'm a strong supporter of the renewable fuel standard. And, you know, in my mind, the ethanol policies we've had in this country are a prime example of good government policy. They were there, provided a subsidy for ethanol to help to get off the ground and reach commercial scale, and then those subsidies expired. And today, ethanol is able to compete with petroleum-based products in the transportation fuel market on a heads-up basis, and that's an example of good government policy. Now, we do need the renewable fuel standard because one of the challenges that ethanol has is that the oil companies have a significant amount of influence and control over the distribution channels, and we need that renewable fuel standard, because that creates a level playing field for ethanol to be able to make sure that consumers have the option of buying that product at the pump.
What about the aspect of that question making renewable fuels have national appeal?
Well, I think they do have national appeal. The fact of the matter is that ethanol today provides 10% of the supply in the market. And the fact of the matter is, if we did not have ethanol and it was all done through petroleum-based products, that the price that you and I pay every time we go to the gasoline pump would be higher. And so I think, you know, all consumers across America have a desire to have more product choices and more affordable choices, and that's what that ethanol brings to the market. And I think that's one of the things that we can do a better job of marketing, if you will, the benefits of ethanol, is that that really helps bring down the price of transportation fuels for all consumers.
Related to that, let's talk about agriculture policy. Even with a former Iowa governor heading up the agriculture department, farmers were kept in limbo for years over new farm policies. How will you represent the interests of agriculture and rural communities in an environment and from a district that is heavily urban?
Sure. Well, I was very happy and pleased to have received the endorsement of Bill Northey, our great Secretary of Agriculture. And, you know, that's a question I got from people. It's, Mark, you're a business guy. Some people were a little bit surprised by that. But, you know, the reason that Bill did do that is that, number one, agriculture and our farming is a business. And I understand business, and I understand the some of the complexities that government policy can get in the way of creating growth and opportunities in that private sector. I've worked very hard to understand the agricultural business. I'm the only candidate in the field here that would have supported the farm bill that got passed. And to be clear, it was not a perfect piece of legislation. No piece of legislation is. But farming is a business that's fraught with risk and uncertainty, and I think it's appropriate that we provide a safety net for our family farms.
You're campaigning, Mark Jacobs, to join Congress at a time when its approval ratings are some of the lowest in history, depending on what poll you look at. Congress is in the low to mid-teens in most cases. Can you explain how we got to that point with such low approval for Congress?
Well, again, the last poll I saw, I think it had Congress at a 9% approval rating. And I got to tell you, as I've traveled across this state, I'm still looking for somebody in that 9% because I haven't found them. Pretty much everybody I've spoken with is not happy with Congress. But my view is we've created a toxic environment in Washington where there's bitter partisanship and name-calling, and the bottom line is nothing's getting done to solve problems that we have. And I think that's a great source of frustrations for people across this state. It's a source of frustration that I have. My view is that we're not going to change Washington by sending the same old type of person there. And for us to send another career politician and somehow hope for or expect different results, to me, doesn't make a lot of sense. And, you know, what I've learned over the course of my business career is how to work with people who have different points of view and still get done what needs to get done in a way that's consistent with my values and principles.
Perhaps you could give an example of that. In what areas can you imagine compromising with the Democrats to get something accomplished for Iowa?
Sure. I'll give you one example here is to eliminate fraudulent and wasteful spending in our federal government. And I think that's a area that we are likely to find common ground on. One of the statistics that's jumped out to me is the fact that up to 15% of Medicare reimbursements are fraudulent. Now, that comes at an annual cost to taxpayers of nearly $90 billion a year. And I've had my credit card number stolen several times in the last 2 years, but each and every time my financial institution caught the very first fraudulent charge for no net loss. And my point is the know-how exists in the private sector to root out fraud and waste, and what we need to do is bring that to our federal government. And I would hope that that's an area that we could find bipartisan support to tackle that fraudulent, wasteful spending.
Let me ask you about another area of bipartisan friction. When do you think it's appropriate for a senator to block a presidential nominee? In what cases would you do so?
Well, I think you have to look at the whole picture, but, you know, our form of government was set up with a series of checks and balances. I will tell you, I take those very, very seriously. And one of the roles that the United States Senate plays is to confirm judicial nominees. And I'll tell you, the criteria that I will use in examining a judge's record is to make sure that they have a record and a belief of upholding the Constitution of the United States of America and not legislating from the bench.
Nearly every candidate, especially in this GOP primary, says they want to cut government waste and bring down the deficit. You were talking about cutting waste just a moment ago. Can you name a program or a department that you haven't yet that you would cut, and why?
Well, I think within each department there is inefficiencies, and I think that it is more appropriate for us to look at how can we root that out. I'll give you another example. Our federal government today owns 77,000 buildings that are either unoccupied or partially occupied. You know, that makes absolutely no sense at all, and that comes at an annual cost to taxpayers of billions of dollars a year, plus the investment that our government has in these buildings for which we're getting no value. And, you know, that's an example of something that I would look to root out and to go after. I'd also support the idea of an across-the-board 10% cut to the administrative budget of every federal agency. Now, I'm not talking about the program costs. I'm talking about the cost of the government basically running itself. But that's one of the tools that's used in business quite frequently, and it forces managers to prioritize, to look for ways to be more efficient, something that I see rarely goes on in the federal government today.
Mark Jacobs, are we spending enough on national defense?
Well, I think we need to ensure that we have a strong defense. I come from the school that the cheapest and safest war is the one that we don't fight, and I think we get there through a position of strength, and we get there through a position of leadership in world affairs. One thing that's clear to me is that the nature of the threat that we face is changing. 20 years ago, we could have pulled out a map and determined by geographic boundary where the bad guys were, and today that's much more difficult to do because it's driven by ideology and expectations for what our national defense needs to look like. Number one, we need to make sure that we have more special operations capabilities. We need to be prepared to combat cyber terrorism, which is an increasing threat. And we need to be able to defend against the use of unmanned vehicles, the so-called drones, whether they be subsea, terrestrial, or airborne. And I've heard a lot of conversation about how our use of drones, but not much conversation about how we can defend against their use against us.
Another big issue in recent years, immigration. Immigration reform is an issue that's important to Iowa, but it has stalled in Congress. What immigration reforms could you support?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do on immigration is to secure the border. To me, it's inexcusable that we can't control who enters this country. And it's inexcusable to me that people that come on temporary visas, that we can't monitor those people, and if they've overstayed their visas, be able to identify where they are. So that's the first thing we need to do. The second thing we need to do is we need to hold our employers accountable for making sure the people they employ in their businesses have the legal right to work in this country, and we need to make sure that our federal government provides tools to business and industry so that they can verify that employment status. Once that's done, you know, then we need to deal with the modernizing our immigration process. We need to deal with the people who are here in this country illegally. But again, I would start with securing the border and holding our employers accountable.
Given those two first prerequisites, would you then be able to, if you were satisfied with those first two items you mentioned, then be able to support some sort of path to citizenship for the 10 to 12 million undocumented workers?
I don't support amnesty. My view is that the people that have come to this country illegally have broken our laws, and I think there should be a fine and penalty for having done so. I support the idea that once retributions have been made, that people who came here illegally could stay under a guest worker type of program, but I do not support the idea that my view is that anybody that came to this country illegally should never be allowed to progress to citizenship or to voting rights.
couple more areas to touch on, Mark Jacobs. According to figures from NASA, 97% of climate scientists agree that climate warming trends over the past century are very likely due to human activities, and that most of the leading scientific organizations worldwide have issued public statements endorsing this position. Do you believe in this science that climate change is happening and that it's very likely due to human activities?
Well, I certainly believe that the climate has changed. You know, our planet has gone through periods of warming and cooling throughout its history. You know, as a former CEO of a large energy company, I've seen a lot of studies on this matter. And, you know, what I will share with you is that my understanding, climate science is incredibly complicated. And there's a lot more about it that we don't know than what we do know. I have seen some of those studies you're referencing that indicate that man-made causes have contributed to it. I've also seen studies that indicate that man-made causes are not contributing it. I think it's an area that we need to continue to study and understand. But if we're going to move forward on any type of climate action, it needs to be done on a worldwide basis. We cannot address the issue here in America. And the idea today that we are taking our coal resources and that we're putting them on a boat and sending them over to China, who is building 70 new coal-fired power plants every year, and they're burning our coal, that makes absolutely no sense at all.
Can you, back to this question of whether human activities are causing the warming trends, the climate changing trends, can you name a climate scientist or organization that is in that evidently 3% that
Richard Lindzen from MIT is one of the more noted ones, but there are several others as well that have gone through some of the analytical data that provide a contrary point of view. And again, I think it's important that we continue to have a robust debate in this country on the facts of that.
And as I understand your earlier question, our government should not act, should not do anything unless we do it in concert, in unison with the rest of the world.
If we're going to move forward on this, it is a global problem. It is not a United States problem. And the only thing we do by moving forward on this unilaterally is we are going to devastate our economy, and we're not going to solve any problem.
Okay, and finally, Mark Jacobs, let's talk about healthcare. You touched on it earlier, but let's talk about it a few more minutes. The U.S. House has held dozens of votes to either to repeal, defund, or otherwise dismantle the Affordable Care Act, also called Obamacare. President Obama will not sign legislation repealing, defunding, or dismantling this legislation. But the law, we know, remains unpopular, according to polls, with most polls showing more people opposed to it rather than in support of the law. What are your ideas for revising the law? Realistic ideas, considering President Obama will likely be in office until the end of 2016.
Well, I think you're right. Being pragmatic here, as I said, I think the likelihood that the Affordable Care Act is going to be repealed while President Obama is in office is highly unlikely that that's going to happen. But that doesn't mean that, this is not a fight worth having, because I think the Affordable Care Act is an incredibly poor piece of legislation that takes our country in exactly the wrong direction. You may have noted that a couple months ago, the Congressional Budget Office came out with an analysis of Obamacare on employment, and it concluded that because of Obamacare, 2.5 million less people would be working. Now, President Obama has tried to spin that as that's a good thing. People will have more leisure time. I got to tell you, I don't buy that one bit. I think the core problem we have in America today is not enough people working and paying taxes, and too many people who are forced, because of a lack of opportunities, to turn to the government for support. And so a major piece of legislation that takes us the wrong direction, to me, is absolutely the wrong way to go.
You say it's a fight worth having, even though you concede that there's nothing going to happen in terms of repealing, defunding, or dismantling this legislation. Why have the fight if nothing can come of it to change the law?
Well, I think just because it's hard doesn't mean it's not something worth having. Look, as I go all across the state, it's translating into people losing insurance coverages. It's resulting in reduced work hours. And, you know, I what's interesting is the Des Moines Register ran a story here within the last week on the impact of the Affordable Care Act, and they concluded that 70,000 people now have been able to get health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act. And that's from a number of 305,000. Now we have 235,000 that are uninsured. But we have upset the apple cart and disrupted the insurance coverage for 2.5 million Iowans to achieve that. I support the idea that people should have access to affordable health insurance, including those with pre-existing conditions. But we can tackle these problems in a way that is not a government takeover of our healthcare system, which is where this is headed. You know, look at the problems we're having today with the VA hospitals. You know, my concern is that we're getting a glimpse now into what an increased role of the federal government will look like in healthcare, and it's not a pretty picture.
Mark Jacobs, Republican candidate for Iowa's U.S. Senate seat, thank you very much for spending time with us. Thank
Ben,
you very
thank
much.
Thank you. You bet. Take care.
You take care. Bye-bye.